Welcome to this week's edition of the Women's International News Gathering Service. My name is Sarah Olson with the Welfare Radio Collaborative in Oakland, California. Coming up in the next half hour.
I wasted 18 years in domestic violence relationships. Scratches, black eyes, bruises. This is just the way life is.
Marriage promotion is problematic because it invades people's privacy, their ability to live their lives the way they want to.
We're not against marriage. We're just for using marriage the way it was ordained to be. A man respects the woman.
The Bush administration is promoting marriage among low-income women, what they say is a solution to poverty. Yet low-income women are saying marriage is the last thing they need to help them out of their economic woes. Even though there are no laws specifically funding marriage promotion activities, and in spite of the fact that some members of Congress have objected to federal welfare dollars promoting marriage, the Health and Human Services Department is funding marriage activities. Federal dollars are currently offering cash grants for some women to get married and are funding faith-based counseling programs. As Welfare Radio Collaborative correspondent Kimberly Ross reports, survivors of domestic violence are outraged by these developments.
My name is Leilani Luia. I'm a single mother of three girls, 15, 9, and 3 years old. I got married to a man that I had been with for 7 years, and a year into the marriage, he hit me across the face in front of my children. He was arrested and went to jail on Saturday and was out on Monday. At that time, I was working a good job and thought everything was going to be great. But I realized that my life had been turned upside down, and I was left to pick up the pieces on my own.
Over 50% of women on welfare are survivors of domestic violence. In 2002, the Bush administration introduced the Healthy Marriage Initiative. Domestic violence counselors say the initiative could make it more difficult for women like Luia to leave their abusive husbands. The Healthy Marriage Initiative is pending in Congress as part of the current welfare reform legislation.
Our society rests on a foundation of responsibility and character and family commitment. Because family and work are sources of stability and dignity, I support welfare reform that strengthens family and requires work.
President Bush is promoting marriage and strong families as the cornerstone of successful welfare reform.
For the victims of domestic violence, it can be very dangerous. And when we talk about TANF, which is the Temporary Assistance for Needing Families Program or welfare, the majority of women who are on TANF are victims or have been victims of domestic violence. It's not just some small percentage, it's the majority. And so it's critical that their needs and safety are taken into account.
Kirsten Stewart is Public Policy Director at the Family Violence Prevention Fund. She says marriage promotion administered through welfare puts the lives of low-income women in jeopardy.
I mean, no one says victims of domestic violence stay in abusive relationships. What they say, though, is they send out a lot of messages to women that say, well, it's better for kids if you're married. It's bad for kids if you get divorced. And oh, by the way, here's money for you if you get or stay married. Well, when you don't have a lot of money, when you're trying to put food on the table, when you're maybe trying to buy a birthday present for your kid, that means a lot. And so they may not try to be coercive, but the practices themselves are coercive, and they're not better for children.
The Bush administration claims marriage can provide economic stability and self-sufficiency. Leilani Luia disagrees.
They don't have a clue what it's like to be abused and then have your life turned upside down because you did go and get married. You did do everything that society, quote-unquote, says that you're supposed to do. And the person that's supposed to love you abuses you and says that it's a mistake and that you're supposed to be able to move on from that when you're suffering behind being depressed. and suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder because it was traumatic to you. And for Bush or the government to be deciding that the key to poverty or the solution to poverty is to get married. I did get married. It didn't get me out of poverty. As a matter of fact, it sent me back into poverty. I thought I was getting to a point where I was self-sufficient, and all of that was taken away behind a hit in the face.
Luia applied for welfare after she left her abusive husband, but says experiences with an insensitive caseworker added to her trauma.
And he goes, in the program, the CalWORKs program, my goal is to get you to work. So, you know, you basically need to move on with whatever's going on. You need to just buck up and do it. And I felt worse than I did when I walked in there.
Luia says the welfare system isn't structured to deal with domestic violence.
Well, I would say that Healthy Marriage Initiative starts really with the 1996 welfare reform originally.
Avis Jones DeWeaver is the study director for poverty and welfare at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. The 1996 welfare reform legislation she is talking about begins by invoking welfare as, quote, an essential institution of a successful society which promotes the interests of children. This language provided a springboard for the Bush administration's policies.
Embedded within that original legislation was some language that talked about the benefits of marriage. However, there was not any funding attached to that language. So it was not anything that kind of like was overtly funded, obviously, by the government. However, with the Healthy Marriage Initiative, we're talking about now being able to tack some money onto that language. And as a result, what we have is a situation where anywhere between $100 and $200 million so far has been plunked into different programs, looking at different strategies towards providing people with things such as counseling programs, information on overcoming conflicts, public education campaigns, campaigns meant to take place in schools, kind of promoting how wonderful marriage is, those sorts of things, as well as millions and millions of dollars based on research that have gone to several different organizations charged with the task of looking at these programs to see if, in fact, they do help promote so-called healthy marriages.
Written into the 1996 welfare reform legislation is a 5-year mandatory review. DeWeaver thinks it's unacceptable that this review is nearly 2 years late, and yet the focus remains on marriage promotion rather than viable solutions to poverty.
In the future, however, with the reauthorization of welfare that is still yet to take place, there is the hope on the part of those in favor of this sort of strategy to be able to fund programs like these to the tune of some $1.5 to $1.8 billion. And so there is definitely a strategy out there to more greatly fund these programs and to do it, unfortunately, from a pot of money that really should be going towards meeting the needs of the poor.
The Healthy Marriage Initiative would be administered by the Health and Human Services Department, which declined to comment for this program. There are no laws in place that fund marriage promotion, but attorney Tim Casey at Legal Momentum found the Bush administration is already funding it with money earmarked for other programs.
There's a refugee resettlement program which Congress created to provide services to refugees who are relocating to the United States to help them adjust to the new circumstances in this country, and they're taking some money from that. There's a child support enforcement program which is supposed to help collect child support, and they've taken some money from the child support enforcement program. There's a child welfare program, various child welfare programs that provide funding for services to children in low-income families, and they've taken some money from that. There are some Native American funding streams from which they're taking some money for marriage promotion. So basically, in many, if not most of the programs where they have some discretion over the funding, they've taken at least some of the dollars and have targeted those monies for marriage promotion, even though Congress has never approved funding specifically targeted to marriage promotion.
Casey's research found little oversight for these new government-funded marriage programs. He says this can lead to gender bias when allocating funds.
Tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpaying funds are being given out to groups who have no real record of providing valuable services to low-income populations in ways that are sort of hidden from the public. And we found there was one project in Pennsylvania, for example, that was overtly and explicitly discriminatory against women. It was a project in Allentown, Pennsylvania, a marriage promotion project that offered counseling services to unmarried couples to try to persuade them to get married. But then it offered employment services, but only to the fathers, not to the mothers. So it was overtly discriminatory, as set out in the project description.
Legal Momentum filed a lawsuit challenging the legitimacy of this program. For the Women's International News Gathering Service from the Welfare Radio Collaborative, I'm Kimberly Ross.
Many welfare recipients say living in poverty creates an environment of violence. They say poverty is violence. Violence created by a system that ignores basic needs and human dignity. Historians cite trends in regulating reproductive lives of low-income women, especially those of color. Forced sterilization throughout the 20th century, popularization of black women as welfare queens, and stereotypes of over-sexualized Latina women. These widely held beliefs about poor women have cultivated a climate that encourages these regulatory policies.
Between three men, I wasted 18 years in domestic violence relationships. My kids had to see it. I didn't even know how to talk to them about it at the time. I just remember always telling them, you know, just go back to bed. It'll be all right. You know, scratches, black eyes, bruises. You know, this is just the way life is.
Welfare recipient Rosa Fulmore has moved on from these abusive relationships and is currently enrolled in college. She says it was a long road getting there.
And I think because of the type of environment that I grew up in, it was the projects, gangs, drugs. It was normal to see a husband beat a wife or, you know, a friend to come over and say, oh, my mom and dad are going at it again today. My mom has a bloody nose because my dad punched her. And I'll just go home right now when they calm down. I mean, that was just like normal. It wasn't something that it was odd. And, you know, it happened everywhere around the projects. That was normal life. So when I started getting into relationships and things like that started happening to me, I didn't think nothing was wrong.
Fulmore says education opened her eyes.
You know what worked for me? Getting me into the school, getting me educated, getting me around a different environment, an environment that I never knew my whole entire life. I've been a welfare recipient since 1980. And it took me to 2001 for me to even know that I can go to school and that there's a whole different life out there, different type of people, different environment.
She says you can't fight poverty with marriage.
That's why I don't understand how they could promote marriage through welfare. Okay, so fine, you get your bonus, marry him. We'll add him on $100 more a month. Is it going to be worth my ribs being broke, my jaw being broke, my kids being mentally stressed, or me finally going over the edge where I can't take it no more?
Fulmore says that by offering her money to get married, the government is trying to coerce her into a particular lifestyle. This is not the first time the government has tried to regulate women's personal lives, says Mimi Abramovitz, author and professor at City University of New York and Hunter School of Social Work.
In the early 1900s, there was a family limitation movement, and it was supported by feminists and unions because they felt that if women could have contraception, they'd be more likely to have more rights, more independence, and so on. And here we see the beginning of fertility control. Poor and black women in particular. Between 1940 and 1960, one-third of all Puerto Rican women of childbearing age were sterilized under these kind of programs. And then, starting in the 1970s, I think it was a lawsuit or something, revealed an enormous amount of sterilization abuse in the United States, mostly women of color who were being sterilized without their consent, often as they were about to deliver, they would be asked to sign a consent, and they may have been doped up. They may not have spoke English because it was both black women and Latina women. And so between 1970 and 1973, there was a 350% increase in the number of women who were abused, who were sterilized, often against without any voluntary consent. And then from 1976 to 1982, the rate doubled. So there always seemed to be some sense that it was okay to regulate the childbearing rights of poor women, especially women of color, always in the name of something else, whether it was anti-abortion or population control. It's interesting that the target was women of color first. And of course, you have to link that to racism.
Lisa Lynn Jacobs, Vice President for Government Relations at Legal Momentum, says governments around the world deny access to adequate health care, birth control, and sexual education as a way to control low-income women. She says the Healthy Marriage Initiative is only the latest example in a trend of regulating women's reproductive and sexual freedoms.
You know, I think there clearly have been historical incursions, if you will, or inroads and attempts to constrain particularly women's reproductive freedom. I mean, I know we all know about Roe versus Wade and the extent to which that conferred choice and access to various reproductive options on women. I think the first problem or the first roadblock that we encountered came up in the late 70s with regard to the Hyde Amendment. The result of that largely was that poor women found that choice really wasn't an option for them. Choice is a great thing. Unfortunately, healthcare in this country costs an awful lot of money. And as a result, the reproductive options that were available to women who had some means were not the types of options that were available to poor women. You know, they might not be able to get birth control. They certainly did not have access to abortion. And I think that was sort of the first inroad. I think certainly in more conservative administrations, the global gag rule is another big one. The extent to which funding has been denied to the UN, particularly the United Nations Fund for Population Assistance, to prevent them from talking about issues like contraception, to prevent them from distributing contraceptives, to prevent them, really the effect of that is to prevent women around the world from being able to control their reproductive destinies. It is also to deny them various types of health access.
Mimi Abramovitz says government jurisdiction over women's bodies is the result of a set of stereotypes.
You know, there's a very well-known racial stereotype around sexuality, female sexuality, that black women and Latina women are hypersexed. Okay, so which then is the Latina bombshell, the sexualized black woman, and these racial stereotypes become used to justify these regulatory laws and regulations. If you're trying to reduce government spending on a program like welfare, and if you have this stereotype that women of color are hypersex, well, and if the program is for dependent children, you put this all together and you begin to build a justification, sometimes unspoken, but playing to the hidden racial stereotypes, that it's okay, even good, to regulate the childbearing behavior of women because, after all, they're hypersex, they're having too many kids. All the while that those arguments are going on, the number of children in the average welfare family was falling, just like the number of children in the average family in general.
Jacobs of Legal Momentum says the policy of promoting marriage sends a bad message to women.
I think we are sending a couple of messages. We are suggesting perhaps that women or single parents are not whole or are not sufficient unless they are married. I think that we are trying to impose Judeo-Christian values, our Judeo-Christian values, on other people and query whether or not that is appropriate. There are these sorts of hyper-Christian notions about what a family looks like and about the fact that, you know, a family is broken or no good if it doesn't look like father knows best, with mom and pop and mom staying at home and dad going to work and mom staying home and taking care of the kids.
listening to the Women's International News Gathering Service. I'm Sarah Olson. Christianity's influence on social and legislative policy is something many religious welfare recipients can relate to. Social policy experts say the Healthy Marriage Initiative has to do with the Bush administration's strong ties to right-wing Christianity and represents part of a moral agenda central to Bush's evangelical base. As correspondent Karina Muniz reports, political proselytizing about the moral obligations of low-income women is invasive and unwelcome.
I was in a marriage for 13 years, and this man, quote, said he was a Christian. I was married from 1984, and he began to manifest his violence 2 or 3 weeks into marriage.
Sylvia Derensberg is a survivor of domestic violence. She says the church put its interpretation of God's law above the reality of her violent marriage.
He begged me not to get an annulment. And because I was thinking, you know, I want to live and let live. I want to give you a chance to have what I thought I had, a good life. I came into the marriage with good credit, working a good job, and thought that I was on top of the world and I could take somebody with me, but he took me down with him. And I stayed with him off and on, off and on. Every time he cried and said, oh my God, I just want someone to love me. No, he wanted someone to suck dry and then like a sponge wring me out and throw me away and his 3 children away. And I came to the realization, even though you were in church, that is only an excuse to get what you need instead of facing up to the fact that you were hurt and you're going to turn around and hurt somebody else.
Derensberg says her church community and the government ignore root causes of violence. She says people she trusted pressured her to stay in a violent marriage.
I left him and went to domestic violence shelters. I went back to him because people, so-called good people in the community, said, you need to stick by your man. You need to help your man. You are in violation of God's commandment to honor your husband and to respect him. And all of these things over the 11 years I was married to him. And this guy would brutally smash my head against windows, throw me up against walls. I thought of 1,000,001 ways to make this marriage work for everybody but me.
Marriage is the greatest institution that has ever been established upon the face of the earth. Marriage was established, the first institution that was established upon the face of the earth. Marriage was established and ordained by God in Genesis 2:24, when it said, therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh.
Malachi Hall is the pastor at the Mount Zion Church of God in Christ in Berkeley, California. He says marriage should be valued above all else. Sylvia Derensberg thinks a marriage lacking mutual respect is no marriage at all.
And I want to say to G.W. Bush, you don't want to propose that I go back into a situation that brought me down until you can give me what I need so I can attract the quality man. Don't dare try to give me the trash that I've gone through over and over again before simply because you want a balanced budget. You want a scapegoat on the poor woman. But we've grown to the point that we know that we don't have to resort to this, and we're not going to tolerate it, and we're not going to support the marriage proposal. We're going to do everything we can. We're not against marriage. We're just for using marriage the way it was ordained to be. A man respects the woman.
The African American Healthy Marriage Initiative is a subsection of the Healthy Marriage Initiative and promotes marriage in Black communities. Derensberg says the initiative isn't looking at the whole picture.
I've always had domestic violence in my life. My mother was violated by my father, and I never saw it, but the atmosphere was in the house. And I consider myself kind of blessed growing up in all-black community, but it was a post-slave community. And I always ask why there was so much violence.
African-American women are not the only women of color targeted under these policies. The Hispanic Healthy Marriage Initiative is another subsection of the Healthy Marriage Initiative and promotes marriage among Latino women. Maria Jimenez from Mujeres Unidas y Activas says this is problematic.
Aquí no, aquí nosotros motivamos a nuestras hijas, mi hija salga adelante, no se vaya a casar, usted estudie. Yo veo constantemente los consejos de las mujeres a sus propias hijas.
Here we motivate our children to reach their goals, to get an education, not just to get married. In the advice I see women giving to their daughters during the talks we have, they motivate their daughters to study so that their goal isn't just to get married. Their goals go beyond marriage. Yes, you can get married, but when you have your own career. Get married when you've finished your own studies. Get married when you've found the right partner. But don't get married because you have to.
In communities across the country, constitutionally protected rights are endangered, according to LaShawn Warren, legislative counsel at the Washington office of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Marriage promotion is problematic because it invades people's privacy, their ability to live their lives the way they want to. And I mean, I think there's something paternalistic about a government that requires poor people to get married but will give benefits to more affluent people, like, you know, the wealthy tax cuts, that's giving them money. But they don't administer or mandate to those people how they need to live their lives. But it's interesting the kind of mindset there is about sort of making poor people live their life in a certain way. And you see a huge conflict there. And the ability to marry someone, a decision to marry someone, is a personal decision, and it's not something that should be mandated by the government.
One of the things Warren has found is that women are often on welfare because of domestic violence.
There are multiple issues that sort of result in women being single and raising the kids, you know, on their own, but it takes a lot for a woman to leave a man who has been very abusive to them. And do you want to make money the incentive for her to go back into an abusive relationship? Oftentimes it's life-threatening. You can pay her an extra $5 a month, but is that worth her life? And actually, you are really giving her, you're paying the woman to put her life and her children's life in jeopardy. And is that a good, sound public policy?
Welfare recipients say no. Although the Bush administration alleges that married couples do better than single parents, Rosa Fulmore says her life was not made easier by the supposed additional income from her past marriages.
What two incomes? He's on my budget. What two incomes are there?
A better use of tax dollars, says Fulmore, would be to offer low-income women education, counseling, and meaningful employment opportunities.
When I went back to when I started getting therapy, when I went back to school, that's what really did it for me. When I started talking to counselors there at the school, when I started getting educated, okay, not only in education as far as, you know, school-wise, but on the domestic violence part, because I found out there were so many other women in school like me, and I think it gives you more strength, more power to really stand up and say, no, that's it, I'm not taking it no more.
For the Women's International News Gathering Service, from the Welfare Radio Collaborative, I'm Karina Muñiz.
You've been listening to the Women's International News Gathering Service. Special thanks to Pauline Bartolone and Justin Beck. With the Welfare Radio Collaborative, I'm Sarah Olson.